Hi, this is Dan, and this is Still Dan, and I'd like to welcome you to PD Pal, a monthly podcast about all things pediatric palliative care, which, after 3 years, still sometimes has major technical difficulties. The views expressed in this podcast are ours alone, and do not represent our respective institutions. They do not constitute medical advice. You also probably don't want to take any technical advice from us either. So Dan, why are you doing this intro by yourself? Well, Dan, if you'll recall, during the interview itself, my internet connection was particularly spotty, so I couldn't meaningfully participate in the conversation. Here in pediatric palliative care, we want to make sure everyone's voice is heard. So Sarah and I decided that I'd do this part by myself. And since Sarah's not here to stop me from coming up with questionable metaphors, it strikes me that maybe there's something fitting about having communication difficulties in an episode about neuropalliative care. Now, to explore that further, here are our guests. Aunt Sarah. But not me.
I'm Marina Ma. I currently work at Baylor College of Medicine. I'm based at Texas Children's Hospital, and I do 80% PEDS rehab medicine and then 20% PEDS palliative care.
I'm Lauren Treat. I am a general child neurologist and pediatric palliative medicine doctor at Children's Hospital, Colorado.
I knew pretty early on I wanted to do physical medicine and rehabilitation, PM&R. I love medicine. I love neurology, but I felt I wanted to focus on function. I wanted to focus on quality of life. And I felt that PM&R was the specialty that resonates the most with me. As I was going through my fellowship, I just felt there is something missing, that we take care of a lot of kids who have a lot of serious neurological injury, or their diagnosis from the very get-go is life-limiting or life-altering. And I just felt that I didn't have the language, I didn't have the words, I didn't have the skill to help the parents. So that's why I did the fellowship in pediatric palliative care. To me, to marry those two specialties, pediatric rehab medicine and pediatric palliative care, I felt that I am so fulfilled, and I'm so, so grateful that I'm able to do both at the same time.
Similarly to Marina, I feel like it's a very natural extension of neurology to do pediatric palliative medicine. I always knew I wanted to be a neurologist. I love the brain. I find it endlessly fascinating. And especially in pediatrics, getting to have a front row seat to child development and all of the dynamics that happen over the course of the early years of life is just an incredible privilege. And when I was in my early years of training, because you match in child neurology for a 5-year program, and so when I was in my general pediatrics years, I already knew I would do child neurology and would already kind of start to cohort or lean towards the neurology cases, and started to really see the gaps in how we were talking to these families. We could talk to them about all of the quantifiable things about their rates and volumes and regimens and seizure frequency and things like this, but we wouldn't talk to them about the impact this would have on their marriage, or the impact that this would have on the siblings, or how, you know, these things that aren't solvable and aren't necessarily quantifiable were going to be part of this new world that they were entering. And so I really felt like that was not fair to them when we knew things about their future that we weren't able to talk to them about. And so that's what really propelled me towards finding something else in addition to the standard way that neurology was being practiced. Fortunately for me, there were a lot of people on the adult side doing neuropalliative care in Colorado. And so I was able to kind of take that validation on the adult side and bring it to the pediatric side, which is something we do already in neurology. We learn a lot on the adult side and apply the principles. And so it felt like a very natural way to bring palliative medicine to the pediatric child neurology realm.
It's funny, we just finished recording an episode with Julie Hauer about how we sit in this realm of pediatrics and pull things from the adult world and figure out how to apply them in pediatric situations. And I hear both of you did that. At the same time, I'm thinking about Julie Hauer as someone who's very invested in the same patient population you both touched on, is this severely neurologically impaired patient population. Thinking about how you described yourself, Lauren, as a neuropalliativist or someone who does neuropalliative care. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that word and when you first heard that word and what that word means to you.
So I think when I was starting to really wrap my head around neuropalliative medicine and what it would mean for me to practice in this way, I saw neurological disease as a unique entity that really affects the way that people conceptualize of themselves and of each other. So your ability to think and reason and move and have agency and independence and have personality really comes from your neurological functions. And so when those things are disrupted, there is a very profound impact on what you feel is your self-identity or what people feel is their ability to relate to you and get to know you and some of these things that are foundational when we talk about quality of life and how someone might choose for themselves or choose on behalf of their child. And so when I think about neuropalliative medicine, it's about saying what is going on medically and then who is the child that lives in this body? How do we get to know them? Who is getting to know them? Who's reporting on that? And is the child that lives in this body feeling like they can be themselves? And how do we see that come through? When I say, how hard has it been for this child to live in their body as themselves? And is it getting better or worse? That's really at the core of neuropalliative medicine.
We underestimate what those kids can do or able to feel and how they bring joy to their families. When I prognosticate, sometimes I say all the scary things, but then sometimes we don't validate when parents say that I cherish this life. I want to take my child home. It doesn't matter with a trick. It doesn't matter with a G-tube. It doesn't matter with a vent. This is a life that matters to me. And sometimes we don't talk enough of that. When I talk about neuropalliative care, there's so much that we don't know, in my opinion. Like I take care of kids with disorders of consciousness. Like I would tell the parents, I worry that your child will never walk, talk, do all the things that they used to do. And 2 years, 3 years later, they're completely different kids. You know, for me, it's so unpredictable at the moment. I always have to remind myself to really think about the family. When I say, let's walk this journey with a family, to take my bias away about what the child is doing or what I think the child can do, and really focus on, are the parents truly have the child's best interest in mind? And if they are, how can I best support that family?
That's a super great point. And I think neurology in particular really struggles with this prognostication piece, especially in children, because children have such plastic brains and there's so much about their environment and what they're able to optimize on in, you know, in therapies and other things like this. And so there's so much richness there and so much that gets woven into their narrative in a really, really early stage about people trying to be very concrete about the outcomes. You know, most of the time they're trying to do it benevolently to try to help families make decisions, but then it creates this whole narrative about outliving expectations or doing better than anyone ever could have imagined. So that it's not just about end of the road, walk, talk, go to school. It's more about what is that time going to look like en route to that end point. And I think that's where neurology also gets a really bad rap, or neuroprognostication in general gets a really bad rap, is because we focus so much on that end point and don't do as well with talking about the journey to get there. So we can do so much better to talk about these things that we do know, even if we don't have crystal clarity about when exactly the timeline is going to happen or what the end point is going to be.
Very fair point. I think sometimes people also get scared of neuroprognostication because of all that uncertainty. I think it's okay to say, if this is 100% recovery where your child is going to be like a typical child or how they presented, and then this is where you're not going to get any recovery, or even this is death, we kind of know which 50% they kind of fall into. We don't know what 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the line, but we kind of have an idea. I agree with you. It's not fair for us to also not give neuroprognostication, while at the same time, we can also be careful and be honest and say, I can be very, very wrong, but in case we are not, or based on my experience, this is what I predict they're going to look like. So I think you give expectations or you give anticipation while giving room for hope or room for things that we don't know about.
Yes. And the conversations are so different. The conversations are very different early on compared to when a family has been walking this journey for some amount of time. And it can be really variable for some families. A lot of families tell me this in clinic where they've said, I realized at some point that doing 12 therapies every week really stole from me the time that I was just able to be with my child. I realized at some point that taking them to 12 therapies a week was in some ways a rejection of how they are currently. And it's not that I then settle for this being our life, but I realized that I'm missing out on life with my kid now if I'm always trying to tell them that they could do better or be better or do something different. And that's a really, really pivotal psychological shift for families. And so many of them say it, but they have to get there on their own, right? That's not something that we as medical professionals can give them. It often doesn't go well if we are trying to kind of rush them to that point or get them to see it in advance. I think there is some influence and responsibility that we have as clinicians to be able to help them see what's happening and layer in our professional expertise about what we think is likely in a humble and gentle and caring way, but it has to be scaffolded onto their lived experience. It's not ever going to be enough for us to just speak to them about what we prognosticate or think is going to be the case.
So I think what I've heard from both of you is these different orbits of training have allowed you to paint families a much richer picture than you otherwise would be able to paint them, both in the psychosocial realm and the medical realm. And at the same time, you've both echoed back what feels like a very standard neuro speech, which is knock, walk, not talk, not eat. And I have worked in a number of different hospitals, and I've talked to people in all sorts of different states. And for some reason, that is the stereotypical speech that almost everybody has. And, you know, I think it's designed to be digestible in small pieces and understandable. At the same time, I found pitfalls, because that's a very physical speech. And I've heard people then, you know, make the assumption that, well, then the mind will be 100% and there'll just be physical limitations. And so I'm wondering if you guys could touch on how maybe over the course of your career, you've evolved how you give this intro speech to a new life with neurologic impairment, or pitfalls that you've seen and traps you've seen families or providers fall into.
I would say that in my talks about the future or what's likely to be happening, I try to, again, build in those things that we'll be looking for, trying not to necessarily ordain that this is going to be the way that I think it's going to be, but partner with them, right? Bring ourselves into alignment that our job is to focus on the child together and walk this journey in this way and give that parent the ability to be a good parent for their child, to know what to look for, to be able to say, oh, I'm in on this. It's not just me, you know, against the doctors or me trying to impress the doctors or convince them or something else like this. It's us together trying to follow the child's lead, just like we say all the time in palliative medicine. A lot of my talks early on are hopeful but worried about this or that, and here's how we're going to know together, because you're trying to build that therapeutic alliance with a lot of trust. And part of what they have to understand is that you're trying to comprehend their angle, right? That you're not just trying to be the expert, but you're also willing to and committed to partnering with them to comprehend what they're seeing and how they're interpreting it and then putting it as part of the plan.
Sometimes I say, time will tell. I can't predict short term, but I think the longer, if we see from a year from now, they're not making a lot of changes, then I think we're more certain of what we're predicting. And I think sometimes that's when I have to ask the parents, for you, what is important? Sometimes from the very beginning, because like say they were born with a severe HIE, they were never able to talk, walk, eat, but they're able to smile, they're able to experience happiness. And sometimes I can prognosticate that way, or I can help the parents make decisions. If the child is no longer able to do A, B, C, and D, those are the things that are important to the parents. Sometimes it helps the parents make the decisions that they need to make.
And a lot of families, when I'm talking about their narrative or their journey through their child's medical and non-medical existence, they talk about how closely they clung to the promise of gene therapy, at least in their early phases. Many of them come to realize at some point it's either not going to happen or the child will still have a lot of issues, even if the gene therapy does someday become available. But there is a really, really big focus, understandably, on the possibility of this all kind of just going away to some degree, right? It's that sense that maybe we won't have to deal with this. Maybe it won't all be real. maybe we can change our fate to some degree. And I think another piece of all of that is people are working on this. People care. There's someone out there who values these children, right? Who hasn't written them off or who can be a source of hope and help uplift the community in that way.
Certainly find the conversations have changed. I mean, with the SMA ones, I'm seeing them like meeting milestones. I mean, the younger ones for sure. And I'm like, holy cow, what am I seeing? I remember walking into this clinic room and I was like, are you sure? Are you SMA one? I'm really happy to be part of their journey. That's why I think I like being rehab and being palliative care, because I get to see both. You know, I get to celebrate the wins. It's not all just about losses. And I think it is also an exciting time because now even kiddos with neuromuscular diseases like Duchenne, they're living longer and longer. And now the conversations have changed. We're thinking about LVADs. We're thinking about heart transplants. You know, it's like they're unheard of. But now I think we just have a lot more choices. And at the same time, I think the conversations, the gray area have also become bigger. And to me, that's where us as people who live in both worlds have, I think, better perspectives or just a richer perspective, as I think you mentioned earlier, Sarah. The Venn diagram just has a lot more overlap.
I would say that the gray for me is going to move more towards phenotypic descriptions rather than diagnosis-based descriptions of where a child is at, right? So if they have a certain lung capacity or they have a certain functional level or other things like that, we're still going to care about the diagnosis and how they got there. But because there's disease-modifying therapies, especially in these neuromuscular conditions, we're going to do a lot more of qualifying their diagnosis based on their function. And that then is going to be more of the discussion about how we're going to move forward with whatever advanced therapy they might be talking about. I think the other piece is that these gene therapies are making things just psychologically so much more complex. There's many people who would say that palliative medicine is less necessary for people now that we have gene therapy, but I completely disagree with that perspective. Palliative medicine is even more necessary for these families because of how psychologically complex their lives are with that decision on board, whether they have gotten the gene therapy or they're considering it. Even if the gene therapy does everything that we hope it does, so many of these drugs are just so very expensive and our healthcare system is grappling with that on a very big level. But to get to age 5 or 7 or 13 or 16 and to know that you received a $2 million gene therapy within your first few months of life, that's got to be a really, really unusual and complex psychological place. And so trying to understand then how that is going to affect the care down the road and their self-conceptualization and all these other things, palliative medicine is well suited to try to be helping these families navigate, even if they don't have as many medical needs as quickly as they previously did with that same condition.
I wonder if there's any advice you would give to the people listening to this who maybe have not had the background and the experience that you have had, but at the same time, maybe having a lot of the same conversations you've talked about. I'm wondering if there's advice that you would give to our listeners when it comes to caring for patients with severe neurologic impairment.
The first thing that comes to my mind is just trust your gut. I think a lot of the conditions that involve neurological impairment, whether genetic or acquired, are deeply tragic. There is a lot of sadness that these families carry and that the clinicians who care for these children also experience. And I think we sometimes try to explain that away, or I've had colleagues say, well, I chose this. I knew what I was getting into. And sure, you make choices along your life to get to where you are, but you also should feel your feelings. And there is a way to practice medicine and practice neurology and practice care of these children with neurological conditions in many different spheres, and also develop the skills to be able to talk to them in meaningful ways and to be able to value their lives, no matter what their disability or impairment is, and to celebrate with the family the joy that the children have and the joy that they bring to their community. There is huge richness to be had in practicing in these areas, and I couldn't be more fulfilled with the combination of practices that I have and the way that I get to deliver care.
I thought about three. So the first one is sometimes we forget to validate the parents that they're doing a good job, that they're being the best parents possible for their child, and that whatever decision that they make, it's going to be the right decision. Sometimes I find the parents questioning themselves so much. Hindsight is always 20/20. It's always so easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but you make the decisions you made because you love your child and you've thought about every possible scenarios, and that's okay. Sometimes it may not be the best outcome, but it doesn't mean you had the wrong intention. And we just figure it out what's next after that. That is something that I need to remind myself, because my tendency is to go, 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 go. And then after they're being discharged from the inpatient rehab unit, I see the parents sometimes asking me, I know you told me therapy is the key. You know, is it okay for us to just take a week to not do therapy because we just got back from the hospital and we just want to spend time with our families? That to me is like when, oh, my heart just sank, because I didn't emphasize how important it is to take care of themselves as a family. And missing 1 week of therapy is not going to change much. Them being as a family, taking care of each other, remembering what's important, I think that's what matters most. Two, I think I want us to remember to give ourselves grace. Same thing that we tell the families that we're doing the best that we can. We also need to remind ourselves that, because I'm certainly guilty of chart checking. And then when I see somebody else doing something different and that worked, I'd be like, ugh, why didn't I think about that? But you know, things are different. Conversations are different. The situation changed. I need to remember that I'm putting my best effort possible at all times, and what I'm doing is enough, more than enough sometimes. So yeah, be kind to myself. To some of the colleagues that may not have done a palliative care fellowship, I so highly recommend it, because the skills that I learn are just, words can't even describe it. I'm so, so, so grateful that I decided to do a palliative care fellowship. I feel that I'm truly able to walk this journey with a patient, with a parent. I'll never forget this patient, and the family always has a piece of my heart. This is a neuro-onc patient with a brain tumor. I was able to be part of the neuro-onc team where I can celebrate all their wins when after like radiation therapy, when they're able to like eat again, walk again. And I was also there, and the parents actually requested my presence when the child no longer is doing well. You know, they wanted me there to be part of the conversations when there is no other option, when the child is actively dying. And I was in the room when the child died. That is such a privilege to me, to be able to earn the parents' trust. And I don't know any other fellowship that allows you to do that, or any other specialty that allows you to do that. And to truly walk the journey with the patient and the parents.
So what were our take-homes from this episode? Well, Dan, I'm so glad you asked. Yeah, that's right, I'm doing this bit solo too. And because Sarah's still not here to be a good influence on me, I'm going to do the other thing that she usually discourages and wax philosophical, so consider yourselves warned. Both of our guests talked about wanting to focus on function and quality of life. The traditional things we discuss when talking about neuroprognosis are whether the child will be able to walk, to talk, to eat, to breathe on their own, which is all about function. Lauren and Marina both emphasized that while function is important, it's not the only thing that determines quality of life or how meaningful a life might be. Which got me thinking about how often we conflate function and quality, and even doing our best to avoid anti-disability bias and ableism, so many of our usual yardsticks for quality of life come back to ability and function. I'm reminded of the families I've worked with in the hospital whose kids have trisomy 13 and 18, who go to such great lengths to humanize their children for the medical team, showing photos and videos of happier times to bridge that gap between a life with such profound lack of function and a life we see as having quality and meaning, or a life worth prolonging or saving. And I come back to what our guests emphasized, that it's all about founding everything on the family's narrative and lived experience. That wasn't too bad, right, Sarah?
Thanks for listening. Our theme song is provided by Kevin McLeod. You can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @PDPal. You can find the notes for this podcast and all of our episodes on PDPal.org. If you'd like to submit thoughts, objections, or ideas for future episodes, please reach out via the email on our website. This has been PDPal. We'll see you next month.
I want to let Dan ask some questions too, but he looks a little frozen. Dan, are you able to hear us?